Very kind words of advice, Harry. Yep.
We'll open the meeting in a customary fashion with a prayer. Oh God, make us conscious of the fact that we are stewards of the body and soul created by Thee for some definite purpose in this world, the which we can only find through daily communion with Thee. Help make this meeting an interesting and profitable one, with a thought in view that it will strengthen us in our resolve to stay sober, thereby making us a fit part of the community in which we live. We ask this in the name of Thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. I feel particularly honored at attending this meeting tonight, particularly because my sponsor is here. Whether he's part of it or not, I don't know, but nevertheless, I feel having rested, sat at his feet, listened very intently to his philosophy, having gleaned a great deal of it, taken part of it, and rejected some. I refer to Warren Chisholm, and I owe him a great debt of gratitude, as well as to those others who contributed a great deal to my philosophy of life. My philosophy is developed a great deal, and it's entirely different from what it had been 6.5 years ago, I assure you, but particularly 8 years ago, when I made my first debut in AA, and being particularly conceited and snobbish and cocky, I, after being in the league for 7 months, I decided that I didn't belong because the other fellows were the alcoholics, and I was just an ordinary drunk. I just drank too much. So I tendered my resignation. I followed this about a month. During that month, as I recall, I was chairman of the group, and I picked four doozies as my speakers, those who had had the worst experiences of any that I'd ever heard. And I had my wife attend these meetings and listen very intensely to their message, and she was properly awed. The last one was he had the smelliest record of any man that I had ever heard. He talked out of the corner of his mouth. Every other word was a cuss word. He was been in every skid row. He bragged about it. In every skid row in the United States, in the more important jails, and even in the penitentiary. And as my wife sat beside me, we had a packed house that night, and as she sat beside me, I nudged her a little bit and suggested to her, "I never did you like that, did I?" She said, "No, thank God you didn't." But when I nudged her the fifth time, she moved over, and she didn't like to be nudged. But on the... I could have nudged her 5 or 6 more times, because I never did anything of the things that he did. So, on the way home, she said that was the most terrible thing that she'd ever heard in her life. "You mean to say that you have to go through meetings like this every Monday night, this old Orchard Grove?" And, you know, every Monday night. You see why I'm suffering the way I am, why I'm not the natural guy, why life doesn't hold any fun for me anymore. I don't enjoy life anymore the way I used to. I'm not natural at home. You have to handle me with cotton batten. I know that. Because I hear you whispering to the children at home that don't make this noise because Uncle Harry's got disease. He might throw a tantrum. He might go out and do something which we'd be ashamed of. I remember those days. So when I asked her point blank, "Well, Lou, do you think that I am an alcoholic?" And she said, "No, I don't think you are, but you certainly were heading for one." It's just like a photo brush man getting his foot in the door. And I had her. So the next morning, I said, well, now, Lou, since you admit that I'm not an alcoholic, what do you think that I resign from that group? He said, well, if it's going to make you feel better, why, all right. So, but I think the only honorable thing would be to call up Warren Chisholm and tell him that you're resigning. Well, I don't want to talk to that baby. He's got ways about him, persuasive ways, and I was afraid he'd unsell me. But I'd made up my mind that I couldn't stand this association anymore because I had taken an inventory of everybody in the room of that Orchard Grove group, and I found that they all were worse than me. There was a guy that had, most all of them had been arrested. I never had been. I had, should have been. I had a little pull. I never had drank any alcohol. In fact, I never knew what beer ale was. I felt very out of the class because of the fact that I didn't know what beer ale was. And I never drank tequila. I never drank the other stuff that they all bragged about. So, I took a fearless moral inventory. And this time I found out what made me the guy I was. I realized that I had abused the privilege of drinking, that I had always tried to drink everybody under the table, that I had a false sense of pride in being able to drink everybody under the table. At least I thought I could. I met a few that beat me. But in the main, I drank until the last dog was shot. I was one of the dogs. And if I had been given another opportunity to drink, what would I do? I wouldn't drink so much, I was sure of that. The way I'd become an alcoholic was by not having any respect for the potency of alcohol. And since having drunk too much, all my friends and relatives and everybody else was very sincere about my behavior, and because I was snapping back at them and telling them I didn't like their attitude, I was losing many friends. I told a lot of customers I didn't want their business anymore. And they didn't do what I told them to do, but I realized that something had to be done about my attitude towards people, because maybe they were partially right, but I definitely, at my age, since I had gotten near 50, this is my age away, you wouldn't figure that I'm 56. I was nearly 50, and a lot of the pleasures of life were gone. The only thing left was drink. So, take that away. Take that away from me, and my gosh, what would a man have left? So, I took the inventory, and I realized that by noon I had usually consumed about 20 drinks, and in all honesty, I had to admit that was too much, because that was the time I decided whether I'd work or play. Play usually won. Business came in of itself anyway, and I hired a very good crew of people that did my work for me, and I was executive type anyway, and and I was lucky. So, I told my wife that this plan. Now, I have made the mistake of drinking too much, and in my inventory that the boy told me to take, I know now how I became an alcoholic. I drank too much. I drank at I never had lost my judgment. I usually lost my judgment at the end of the 10th drink, I told her. I wasn't lying very much. She wouldn't have believed that I was drinking 20 by noon. So I said, I'm going to cut that in half, down to 5, and you know, Lou, I can't get drunk on 5 drinks. And I don't want to drink every day. I want to be saved this embarrassment of when we're invited out to bridge parties or other kind of parties, social affairs, that I am not so horribly embarrassed when people pass these drinks around and I've got to lie and say that I'm under doctor's orders the reason I can't take a drink. Now, one thing that AA has taught me, it taught me to be absolutely honest. Honesty is one of the precepts of AA, honesty, purity, love, and unselfishness. And I realized that I have to be absolutely honest, and I can't be when I lie and say that I am under doctor's orders. So under the circumstances, why, I want to have the right to refuse or accept that. Now, I'll guarantee you that if you let me, I won't drink more than 5 in any one day. And the poor girl believed me. She believed that I had some buttons left. She believed that, and she also said that you are more human when you've got a couple of drinks in your belt. You're more fun. You certainly haven't been easy to live with during about 8 months. So I was given this card to play with. In the meantime, I had to talk to that battle-axe Chisholm, and he came over and said, when did you start a drink? And I said, I haven't started, but I'm going to do it in about 2 weeks. So he talked to me for 2 hours, and I insisted that I was right, and as usual. And he insisted I was wrong, as usual. And became a stalemate. So he asked me to listen to 4 or 5 more, and he sent them down. And among them was one of the boys who listened to me, and he said, by God, Frank, I think you've got something there. So he and I became the first alumnus of our Orchard Grove group. And the official alumnus, and he lasted 2 weeks, however, and he came back. I lasted 8.5 months. But when I came back crawling. I was licked. You can't, if you're an alcoholic, you're licked. You can't fool that desire of yours, that gruel. When I came back, I was so completely licked, I didn't have the guts to call up Warren. He called me up. He's been keeping track of me. He called me up and asked me to come back to the group. And I said, no, I'd forfeited the right. I'd resigned. And he said, you didn't resign, you slipped. And I started giving an argument about that. And I said, I resigned. And he said, you slipped. I said, no, I didn't. And he goes, if you feel that way about it, stay away until you agree. So he said, but if you're smart, you'll come down to the meeting tomorrow night. We'd be glad to have you. So the meeting started at 8:30 and 8:45. I was there at 8:30, but the entire gang was standing outside the door over here on Orchard Grove in Detroit. And I couldn't mingle with them because they might say, I told you so. So I waited until they got up into the end of the quarters, waited till 10 or 15 minutes, and then I planned to sneak in the back way. As I recall, the entry was in the back, and I could sneak in the back seat, and no one noticed me, then I'd sneak out again. But when I opened the door, I think it was Jim Brennan was the speaker that night, and had a big crowd. And as soon as I opened the door, it was the end of the side of the door, and I hear a stumble and a little noise. Anyway, the door, when I opened the door, everybody's head turned to see who this baker was. I put my tail between my legs and I crawled the back seat and sat there, and Jim was up there pointing his finger right at me, and everything he said just scorched my soul because he was talking about me. And at the end of the half an hour of that whiplash, then various other comments came from the floor and they did the same thing, and I suffered. Well, I got up and I apologized after they enclosed and they greeted me and accepted me. Very truthful thing, very emotional, but I was sincere. First guy that came up to me was a man I had no particular use for. I used to chauffeur him around at his request. And the worst about him was that he did all the talking whenever he got to one of these prospect places. And the way he presented it was, in my book, a very poor presentation. He got the convert, but I couldn't see it. Rather annoying. He called me up 3 or 4 times a week, as I suppose Warren instructed him to do. And he was the first one to greet me. He's a WPA worker and wasn't in my class, negative. I needed some batten down, folks. But he was the first one to greet me, and glad to see you, Dang. Glad to see you back again. I've been praying for you. And I thought, yeah, sure, you're glad to have me back. You're missing your chauffeur. And another fellow came up to me, and he was glad to see me. Of course, he owed me ten bucks from the time I was in before, and he hadn't ever made an effort to pay it back. Sure, he was glad to see me back, but he'd never get any more $10. Then I went up to Warren and talked to him about how glad I would be back, and but little irritations like these two wait until I get my nerves back, keep these guys off my back for a while. What's the matter with him? And old guy, the WPA worker particularly, he's dumb. He's smarter than you are, Dan. He's smarter than me? WPA worker. Why, sure, he's been sober for 22 months. And you can learn something from him. And the trouble with you, Dan, you're pretty cocky. You got to be slapped down and still some more. And unless you come to these meetings by as though it's a matter of life and death, and listen intensely to what the speaker has to say as to some way of keeping sober, you're missing the boat and you're going to be flopping around like you did before. You better cultivate that guy. Good advice. It was the only advice that seemed to take, and I'm been appreciative to Warren for having given me that advice to bring me up to my back, giving my comeuppance. We can have pride in this association. We don't have to be groveling. There's a difference between pride and conceit. Conceit was my undoing. Pride, I think, the little vestige of pride I had left in my nature compelled me to make the decision to come back to AA and finding it the only answer to my problem. Pride is a thing, pride in wanting to be able to look people in the eye and yesterday I'm a man. I merit your respect. I can demand your respect because I've got my self-respect back again. With this AA plan to follow, I can live this day and every day as long as I ask my God, as I understand Him, to give me the intelligence to grasp His message. which he tells me through my conscience, that I live a decent, respectable Christian life and be ever ready to do his will as he bade me through my conscience. Well, I've been taught that all my life, but I tried my best to do that, but I also wanted to have some fun. For 7 weeks, I attended those meetings, and I sat in the back, fairly back. I didn't open my trap. They can't keep my trap shut now anymore. But at that time, as I recall, the seven meetings that I sat there, very grieved, very sad, very lonely, and feeling very much disgraced, abject. And as I recall, the seventh meeting, a fellow named Appleby, Earl Appleby, died here about a year or two ago, had the crowding stitches. They were sitting their sides laughing because he was so funny. He made me laugh twice, as I recall, in spite of myself. And but at the end of the meeting, I went up to him and I said, "Gee, I'm sorry, I didn't have the guts to get up and say anything at the meeting, but I want to tell you, you helped me, you made me laugh a couple of times, and what's the matter?" And I said, "Oh, I just ruined my life by, I kicked this goner on this day program, and I wish I could be like you. You're the way I used to be. I wanted to be happy, and you are, evidently, upon this program, and how'd you get that way?" "How long have you been sober?" "7 weeks." "My God, you ought to be happy about that now." "How much trouble do you have?" I said, "Oh, oceans of trouble." And I told him a few, and he said, "Well, boy, you haven't touched bottom yet." Taylor, if you're going to be home tomorrow night, if you're home tomorrow night, I'll give you my formula. He said, "Trouble you are, you're thinking of drinking of the fun you're missing. You're thinking of drinking fun instead of drinking trouble. If you're home tomorrow night, I'll give you my recipe, and I'll guarantee you you'll be happy." Well, I'm home every night. I don't hear to listen to radio, and so they came over. Didn't even come in the house. You get your hat and coat on and take a walk. So he says, "Now with every step you take, the reason you're unhappy because you think you have drink and fun. Now with every step you take, I want you to say drink and trouble like this: drink, trouble, drink, trouble." I said, "That's funny. That's academic, childish." And he said, "Well, do you want this or don't you?" "Hell yeah, I'm wasting the evening if you don't want this. You asked me to help you." Well, I said, "Listen to everything that they tell you to do." And I said, "All right, I thought I was smart before, but now I'll do what they tell me to do, even though I think it's silly." So we started off, and about, it hadn't gone more than about one or two lots when, of course, I kept my eye peeled for the neighbors. He had me say it out loud. He said, "You keep on saying it out loud until I tell you to stop. And when you've done it 250 times, then I'll then you too." And I saw three houses down, I saw a neighbor coming off the porch with his wife, so of course I didn't want to have them let them know I was an alcoholic. So I stopped. He said, "Come on, keep on saying it. What are you stopping for?" He said, "The neighbor coming off the porch over there." And he said, "The hell with them, they know you're an alcoholic anyway, don't they? Go on, drink trouble, drink the fruit." Well, I went by there, funny, I didn't even glance at him. I went, "Drink trouble, drink trouble, drink trouble," and I knew they were looking at me. So I went around the block and luckily didn't meet anyone else, and then a house or two from my house, and he said, "Now that's enough, that's 250 times with each step. Now tomorrow night," and every night, the next 11 nights, you do the same thing. And I'll alone. And I'll guarantee you, if you do it, you'll be thinking drink and trouble every time you see a drink. And I said, I think you're a nut. But in order to prove to you that you're wrong, I'll do it. Because I promised I'd do everything he told me to do. So the next night, same time, I got up and got my coat and hat on, and I started to walk, and taking the same beat. And of course, I cheated a little bit. I whispered it. I didn't say it out loud. And I met the same couple coming off the porch. So I stopped, and I said, I suppose you thought I was a little pet last night. And I said, well, we thought there was something funny, but we thought maybe you were paying off an election debt.
Oh, yes, yes, that's it.
Oh, gee. Well, 4 nights later was a Friday night, and I belonged to a gang of people who'd been together. We were going to celebrate our 40th anniversary. I thought it was 39, but 40th anniversary this next Friday night. It's a gang of fellows who I used to play baseball and basketball with, and we used to meet every Friday night before we got married. They changed things a little bit after that. We meet once a month now. We discussed baseball strategy and everything else like that, and with that also a game of cards, Benny Andy. And we kept that thing up, the same gang of fellows for these 40 years. And now, 4 weeks before, I had told these boys that I had a disease and told them about my problem, that I couldn't stand the sight of anybody else drinking while I was drinking, while I couldn't drink, and asked them to not to drink at these poker parties because I couldn't stand it. So, because they were sympathetic with me, they didn't. When they had the urge, they went out in the kitchen. I imagine a poker party when sneaking a drink out in the kitchen, they're doing what I used to do. So, this is the night, this Friday night. I think I'll abduct this runner on the block. No, knowing Earl Appleby, he'd cross-examine me. He knew the conniving, he knew the chiseling, and he said, did you do it 12 straight nights? And if I were absolutely honest, as I vowed I would be, I said, well, I skipped one night, but I made it 13 nights instead of 12. He said, you start from the time they left off. It was 12 straight nights, and I don't want to go around that block 4 more times. So I ran around the block and came to the poker party house. The latch was open, and at first I peeked in, and I saw the gang were having one glorious time. There was a bottle of beer, or glass of beer, and a puddler at a shop alongside of each one of them, like I trained them to drink. And, I had my way wherever I went. And so they were laughing, having a wonderful time. And as soon as I opened that door, their pussies went, like that. Very poor glass. But they became very, as soon as the door opened and they saw who it was, the glasses went underneath the table. Excuse me. I do it at home. And when I saw them do it, I saw how selfish I'd been. How selfish I'd been in demanding that they deprive themselves of a liberty because I couldn't. So I asked them to put it, I told them about the experience of going around the block and told them about my experience, and they laughed, and I said, now, put me to a test, put the glasses back on the table. No, we don't want to bother you again. We'll drink out in the kitchen. I just say one called me a dirty name. And so no, put it back on. And they put the glasses back on. You know why I saw trouble?
I thought so. It's after all just an obsession, isn't it? There was a realization that I was demanding a privilege which I had destroyed. I'd achieved the privilege. I'm different. I always thought I was different than they. And so, put it back on. And they put the glasses back on. You know why I saw trouble? I saw trouble. It's after all just an obsession, isn't it? There was a realization that I was demanding a privilege which I had destroyed. I'd achieved the privilege. I'm different. I always thought I was different than they. There are some people can drink and who are normal people. They travel along in a wavy line like this. We are extremists. We're way at the top when we're happy, and we're lower than very low when we're sad. And if we, without alcohol, we travel in that line as long as we live. There's a definite pattern. The normal person has a little bumpy, a little rounded. He's more fanatic in his life. Now, you add a little tincture of alcohol into that ordinary type, and he gets a little bit of a bump. And he doesn't think very well in his depth of depression, but his pattern changes rather. He usually gets sick when he has too much. But that line where it shoots way off the top, where the loudest, the wildest, nothing will stop us in any one of these parties we do it. And when we're unhappy, we're down there, the whole world's got to know how sad we are. Well, now that pattern still remains about the same. But when it becomes unmanageable, and the jags are truly jagged, and you get these jags on, the friends can't lay their finger on our behavior. See, he's going to be there, he's going to do this, he's going to do that. That's why our lives become unmanageable. Now, we of the jagged type should never, never drink. That's when we hold a certain pattern. That's an elementary psychology. It's quarter after nine. I was going to stop in a half an hour, but I was asked by four or five people to say something, to explain at least, about the Yale Foundation and its plan. I had vowed when I came back that I would not talk about it. I wouldn't try to shove it down anybody's throat, because I had known that the attitude toward the Yale Clinic was rather, shall I say, the least antagonistic. I went there, received this scholarship. I presume it was given me because of my work with the Central Bulletin, at least that was cited or mentioned. The contribution made to that was recognized by Yale, and they said, well, maybe this guy can do something for us. I haven't as yet even tried, because I told them beforehand I would be not be committed to any kind of a bribe or any kind of a promotional plan, that I was seeking information for my own personal benefit. I'm a peculiar kind of a cuss. Anytime I hear somebody knocking somebody, I always want to know the other side of it. Good training to get into. If you hear somebody being abused, find out what the other guy's got to say, so that you have a fair chance for deciding. A lot of gossip that comes down 1104 Prospect comes to my ears. A lot of reputations could have been ruined had I passed that stuff on. But I want to hear the other side of it. And invariably there's a misunderstanding behind a lot of this misinformation. I was at a clinic that was started about 7 years ago by some industrialists who were very much concerned about the tremendous amount of absenteeism caused by alcoholism in the industrial plant. And they endowed this department of Yale for the study of alcohol and its effects on human behavior. Dr. Jelinek, Dr. Haggard, and Dr. Bacon were the consultants on this study. Well, involving on human behavior, they had to get some guinea pigs. And someone told them, or possibly they had read, they heard that Bill Wilson, nearby New York, had found a formula of behavior which solved the alcoholic problem to a greater extent than doctors and psychiatrists had ever succeeded in finding before. So the next year, Bill was invited down there to give his answer to the alcoholic problem, and he stole the show. In fact, from then on, AA seemed to take the show every year. Bill told them a few things and knocked out a lot of previous ideas, into a cocked hat, because he had the facts. He had proof that the Alcoholics Anonymous program succeeded in spite of psychiatry and church and what is the other avenue? The physician. So Delton made his contribution. He was asked to be an advisor in the study of alcoholism. And the next year, two others were added, Marty Mann, and I don't recall who did it, some Cleveland woman. And they were eyed with suspicion by psychiatrists, physicians, physiologists, sociologists. They were interrogated and they were ripped apart and found that things did really click. They argued with them, tried to show that the thing was impossible to work that way. But they made great contributions at this meeting. The next year, six were invited, and they were gambling on these ex-drunks. They were invited from different sectors of the country. One, the farthest one west, went, I think, came from San Diego, and another one came from Pittsburgh, and I think one from Cleveland. Now, what is their purpose? Why have this Yale clinic? What good is it going to do? They believe, like the people who are studying and making cancer research right now, if they can ever find the cause of cancer, it would eliminate a tremendous amount of cancer in the future. You can find isolated bugs. By studying it and finding the cause of cancer, they'll find the answer. They did it with smallpox. Now they know they'll never be able to find any kind of a vaccine to cut out the alcoholic, because everyone seemed to be agreed at the clinic that it was definitely a psychiatric and a psychological treatment necessary for the treatment of the alcoholic. They had wonderful research experiences there of taking an entire colony of Italians in New Haven. It seemed to be greatly populated with Italians. And they took families out of them as test cases and studied them. And had the drinkers and the non-drinkers and showed in analyzing, going back to their records of drinking, of the folklore drinking of way back in the old country, the second generation back, then going on to the present generation, they were able to trace the impact of society the new American society on the old folklore which had been established. Bill Wilson agreed or believed with them that if clinics were established, in educational clinics were established in all the larger communities, manned by a competent staff of someone who would understand alcoholics from an Alcoholics Anonymous standpoint, a capable doctor and a psychiatrist, as well as a sociologist who would be in charge, that if by some way we could whittle the alcoholic or the alcoholic's family into this clinic for discussion, we would able then to analyze the person to find out whether he was a psychiatric case or whether he really was, or a whether he was an alcoholic, whether he was a dope addict. We would then screen out the screwballs and actually find the alcoholic, and then AA would have, if he was AA mature, he'd be sent to AA. In, naturally, depending upon AA to collaborate with him. Well, in theory, it was supposed to work out. Working out excellently in many parts of the country, particularly in San Diego. Worked out for a while in Pittsburgh. Cleveland was supposed to get it first because of its great number of AAs here, but it was rejected by someone. I haven't yet found out who it was. But they were greatly disappointed that it wasn't received with greater favor here and better understanding. So Pittsburgh was the first point of contact. Later, Youngstown. Youngstown, I understand, is operating now. How successfully, I don't know, but they have raised a fund of $32,000 or $40,000 and have purchased the AA hospital there and are operating by the city with an AA. Neil Kennedy, one of our good AAs there, is in charge. Been a little antagonism by AA on account of it. Let's analyze this antagonism for a second. The greatest criticism of the Yale plan is because of the fact that some of these people have been, the AAs who have been appointed as, who have devoted their entire lives to this work, who received their training, it's true, in Yale, have been paid operators. They don't work, Bill makes the distinction, they don't work as paid AAs. They're working there as if they were secretaries. They don't do the actual legwork of AA. They refer these cases, after being screened, to AA if they're supposed to be that way. Well, I know that I wouldn't be, I couldn't reconcile myself to that kind of a life myself, but I imagine there are some people who could do it. Whether it'll work or not, I don't know, but I know they save an awful lot of headaches. If we could screen, carefully screen out every one of the people who come expecting to find an answer to the alcoholic problem. The question presented was, would I, an alcoholic, knowing that I had an alcoholic problem, would I resent going to the clinic with my problem? When I did listen to the man who talked to me, who was referred to me, I listened to him intently. Now, had he told me I have to go to a clinic to have my head examined, I think I'd have thrown him out of the house. I think there's definitely in an experimental stage, And we should keep an open mind at least that people are trying sincerely to do something about the alcoholic problem. Now, to explain further what the ill plan is trying to do, in the ending that I'm saying, they believe that by educating the people about the tremendous worrisome growth of alcoholism, which is reaching such astounding proportions to so that it has reached, as they said, fourth place in incurable diseases behind cancer, tuberculosis, and diabetes. There's one other one in there. I understand we're fourth. Heart trouble. Diabetes comes after alcoholism. We've replaced it. This all in a matter of 5 years from the statistics that were gleaned. In 5 years, we've jumped from 10th to 4th. The study that Dr. Taylor gave you the other day, several weeks ago when I was here, and the figure that we received there at Yale, where that there were 4 million, approximately 4 million known alcoholics, chronic alcoholics in the United States at the present time. Those figures having been gleaned from hospital and police records. And we claim in AA, the last report we've gotten from the New York Foundation, that there are about 75,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the United States. And in my feeble effort at multiplication, I find that the space of 80,000 AAs represents a 2% of the total number of alcoholics that are in the United States. That gives me my lesson for tonight. If only 80,000 out of 4 million have been reached by our method of treating our common problem, shouldn't we thank our almighty God that he saw fit to give us this wonderful privilege, 2 out of 100, what about the other 98? In his divine wisdom, he saw fit to entrust this wonderful gift to us. He's given it to us to nurture, to develop, to make grow and shine as a beacon light throughout the entire community. Or he's given it to us to desecrate, discard, and belittle, and treat it like other gifts that he's given us and which we've abused. Let's remember that. We've been given a wonderful gift, folks. It's the most precious thing that I've ever received in my life. I cherish it, and I'm sure those that have found fun and happiness in this program have also cherished it, and that's why they find the fun in life. I enjoy myself as I've never enjoyed myself before. Oh, sure, there are days of petty annoyances. There's days of when the sun doesn't shine, when I wake up, my wife doesn't smile real sweetly at me. Everything isn't a bed of roses. Sometimes she still has a battle axe. You know, I'm perfect. And I think what a battle axe she was at one time. She was never the battle axe. She was just trying to bring me back to my senses, and I didn't recognize it as such. Very fine woman. I never measured up to her. But now she has to measure up to me. don't tell her that, please. Where are you going? I'm trying to keep peace and quiet at home. You show up too, Warren. But everything is beautiful. Why in the world we didn't have sense enough to appreciate those things that we had when we had them, instead of gambling on losing everything that we had, including our buttons, it hard for us to figure out now. But let's remember that out of all of the dross in this crucible of life, that dross is thrown away. Possibly some of us did have a bit of gold that God saw fit to bring to the surface. We can develop and keep that shining. Let's do so. I'd like to emphasize one more point. I've got to tell this story. I always end my talk that way because I think it's apropos. Not fitting not mention the 12th step in this program. The 12th step in the matter of gratitude, of having received this wonderful thing to pass it on to others. A man claimed that he had dreamt that he was in hell, and he looked around and he saw a bunch of his old friends there. And they were swearing and snarling and spitting at each other for all they were worth. A very most unhappy crowd. Now, in the center of hell, there was a great big table, heavily laden with fine food. And a peculiar thing about each inhabitant was that his left hand was tied to his back, and his right hand, he had a long fork about 6 foot long, which was taped to the tied to his hand. He could dab down in his food and help himself to whatever he wanted. When he tried to get the food to his mouth, however, the fork was so long, and he couldn't get it down there. And that was hell. And immediately the scene shifted and he found himself in heaven. And then he found a bunch of his old friends too, but they were different. They were laughing and smiling and singing and having a wonderful time. Just as you picture heaven to be. And the center of heaven there too was a table heavily laden with fine food. They too had their left hands tied to their back, and they too had the 6 foot long fork which was taped or tied to their hand, and they could dab down on the food and help themselves whatever they wanted. But they had the answer. They helped the neighbor first. And in helping the neighbor, they were helping themselves. If we apply that lesson to AA, if we do our AA work without any thought of any reward, just in definite, great appreciation to our God for having given us this opportunity for service to our fellow man, we would have learned the real way of life.